For queer folks, Tina Fey's film Mean Girls became an instant cult classic for the way it captures the complex dynamics between bullies and their victims. It's something LGBT folks know far too well, from bullies belittling innocent teenagers to bakers who won't bake a cake for consenting adults. LGBT people always seem to be the target of bullies.
Now, if there were only an anti-bullying campaign to end it all. Today, San Francisco-based drag queen Peaches Christ joins us to take a look at bullying in the film Mean Girls and how it carries on the great tradition of teen movies like Heathers and Jawbreaker.
Peaches is bringing her celebrated parody of Mean Girls to Chicago at the Patio Theater on March 3rd. Mean Gays stars from RuPaul's Drag Race, Kimchi, Willem, and Laganja Estranja. Listen as Peaches chats with us about her own high school's version of the Burn Book,
how the film Grey Gardens was made,
and what really makes a scary haunted house. I'm Fausto Fernos.
I'm Mark Fillion.
Get in, loser. We're listening to Feast of Fun.
Feast of Fun is made possible because of fabulous people like you. Thank you. Right now, we need your help. After many years of creating podcasts and videos you love, our dear computer can't take it anymore and is ready to go to the great big recycling bin in the sky. It is heartbreaking to be in this situation.
Visit GoFundMe.com/FeastOfFunComputer right now and give any amount. Help us reach our goal of saving the show's podcasting computer. Every dollar you give goes directly into making Feast of Fun last for years to come. We know we can count on you to make a big difference and continue the show. Thank you for loving Feast of Fun.
Thank you very much. Once again, the link is GoFundMe.com/FeastOfFunComputer.
Hello?
Hi, is this Peaches Christ?
I guess not. Hello, are you there? Can you hear us? Try again.
Hello?
Miss Peaches Christ, it's so good to hear your voice.
Hi, guys.
How are you?
Good, and you?
Good. It's been forever since we've had you on the podcast. We haven't talked to you since you were staging Terror Vault in San Francisco.
Oh, that's right. It's been too long.
It has been way too long.
It was the most terrifying haunted house experience because I had so many photos of Peaches up on the walls.
Totally.
How was the experience of being in drag and then people like coming in purposefully to get scared by you?
And not just by accident.
Well, it's true. I mean, as Peaches, I've been scaring people for decades at this point. And I forget that, you know, drag queens can be scary to people, mm-hmm. especially when they're outside of your regular audience. And of course, this haunted attraction brought in a lot of folks who aren't necessarily drag show attendees. Mm-hmm. So it was interesting to realize that drag in and of itself was frightening to like straight people.
Well, you know, it's like there's a lot of people that get really freaked out when you fuck with gender, and that is probably one of the greatest reasons to do drag.
I have a friend of mine who is scared of drag queens the way some people have clown phobia, and it's tied to that.
I'd say it's the
right.
same thing.
Well, it's very similar. And
who is
it was amazing because, you know, I love haunted attractions, grew up, you know, I'm such a carny kid. I love horror movies and haunted houses and, you know, drag and theater. And so to kind of be able to do this mashup where it was a haunted, a classic haunted house sort of format, but it was a play that I wrote, you know, so that you weren't just walking through and random stuff was happening. It would actually, there was a storyline and a setting and everything. And my character was a satanic cult leader who used children, an army of children, to find her human sacrifices. And when they would come into my satanic chamber, I think they were very surprised that they were told by the children to sit down in pews. Basically, they were in sort of a sanctum. And, you know, that's very disconcerting to people who at this point feel like I was about halfway through the whole show. So I was about 25, 30 minutes in and, you know, they weren't accustomed to sitting down and that really, you could see them because I had like, you know, peepholes where I could see, you know, the audience come in and stuff.
You're so creepy.
Yeah. So you could see them like really uncomfortable looking around. And I don't know if I told you before, but, you know, my entrance was, you know, I came down in a giant freight elevator full of dry ice and satanic music blasting and, you know, lighting. And, you know, so I was stuck up in this elevator shaft and then they would lower me and then I would come in and you could see on the faces, especially of straight men who looked like they'd be the tough guy out in public, mm-hmm. you could see in their faces the recognition like, oh my God, that's a dude. Mm-hmm. And then become very uncomfortable in their physicality. And with our show, if people had opted in to get more interactivity, they wore a red glow necklace. Mm-hmm. And so if those guys were wearing the red glow necklace, I would walk right up to them and grab their, you know, faces with my, both my hands and caress their cheeks with my nails and get right in their faces. Like I was going to kiss them, you know?
And they're like, this is like that weird Craigslist hookup.
Yeah. Well, it was very effective. Let's just say that. And they would look like, I'm going to punch you. You know, like they'd kind of take that pose, like, I'm going to punch you. But as soon as you called their bluff, like as a performer, they'd kind of melt, you know, and become kind of like almost sort of terrified and giddy at the same time.
This sounds like a real life Rocky Horror Picture Show with a freight elevator, with the heterosexuality
of
being challenged by a large cross-dressing Transylvanian.
Yeah, it was. That was the big homage to Rocky Horror was the elevator.
And then I would do a satanic summoning. They got to have sex with you. Not sure if it was a man or a woman.
Well, we limited our interactivity to, you know, we had to do all this training with the actors. So you weren't allowed to touch people in their bathing suit areas. Mm-hmm. That's how we trained them, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, plus, you know, you're ushering through a lot of people every night. So I'm sure, you know, that would wear you down if you went too far with everyone.
I heard Lady Bunny was trying to get in on that until she found out that there was a restriction on that.
Oh, probably, yeah.
I wanted to just put up a glory hole and scare them after sucking their dicks, showing my face.
Well, it's funny because some people did describe some of the experiences as erotic, which was hilarious to us.
Really?
But I think, I think because there was one scene where this mad doctor, he was a taxidermist who was making human-animal hybrids in the basement of his home. Basically, the concept was that all these prisoners were locked up in the San Francisco Mint. And so you learned about the prisoners before you went down into the basement. And then when you went down into the basement, you walked through the different vaults. And then it kind of became this fantasy of these criminals' worlds. So they were fully realized sets and settings and stuff. And so basically you found yourself in this guy's basement where he was creating this really amazing bat creature that was just crazy, beautiful, and terrifying. And he wasn't in the room at first, but he would burst out of this cabinet while the audience was basically being instructed to do different things. They had all these tasks they had to complete before they could get out of the room. And when he would burst out of the closet or the cabinet with this sort of power skull, or what is it called? It's a circular saw that you would use like to cut into someone's skull. You know, this other door would open and the audience would move into this meat locker. But he would always grab one person and say, no, you're coming with me. And he'd pull them into this other secret, like kind of nook. And while they were in there, he was, you know, and he was monstrous. Like all the characters were rotting zombies because they had been down there for so long. But while he was in this little room with the people, you know, and he would choose whoever, usually it was based on their position and whether or not they were wearing a red necklace. He would have, this fake blood on his hands, and he'd be caressing their faces, saying, "Won't you make a pretty piggy, piggy?" You know, and kind of whispering to them and touching their nose. And of course, the gimmick was that the person was then pushed through another door, and they'd rejoin their group covered with their face covered in blood. You know, kind of like, you know, what the fuck happened to you? You know, but in that moment, more than one person, like perverted, depraved gay men typically would be like, "I thought that was so hot when he was, you know, touching my face and calling me a pig."
So it was a real hit.
Yeah. I mean, it was, it started off as something where we were nervous. We'd never done anything like this before. I mean, I had never invested this much time or money into one project. And you know, I partnered with a big, big business in San Francisco to be able to like stage this thing at the San Francisco Mint. And, you know, I basically formed a whole new company called Into the Dark so that we could, you know, attempt to do it. And so there was a lot riding on the line. For me, you know, it was either going to sink or swim, and we weren't going to get a year two unless, we proved ourselves to our business partners. And that first week, I'll tell you, I had many sleepless nights because we, you know, hadn't sold that many tickets, you know, for the run. You know, it was like we were opening and it looked not good, you know. And then we had our opening. We had a preview for friends and family where we tested all the operations just to make sure that the flow would work. I mean, I don't know if I told you guys, but we did this show 24 nights in October, and every night I was in it. There were certain actors who were in it every night, and we did it 36 to 39 times a night. So I was, you know, up and down that elevator 36 times. So we had to make sure that the timing and the flow and the stop gaps that we had created worked. And when that all worked, I felt some relief because I'd never done anything like this before. And then when we opened, and Wednesday was kind of pathetic, like we lost money on Wednesday, and then Thursday was a little bit better, but boom, Friday, Saturday sold out, and then the rest of the run was sold out. And so we far surpassed all of our goals.
Congratulations. That's fantastic. Because I know it's, you know, this is like a passion of yours since you were a child, and it's so great to see that you get to fulfill that. And you're going to bring it back for next year, or a different
variation? Yeah, that's...
Same thing, that's variation? What's the dealio?
Well, that's the big news for me is like, oh my God, we got a year two. Mm-hmm. And not only did we get a year two, but we're formalizing this company and our business partner, you know, we've really shown them what we can do. And so they're more engaged and they want to make it bigger and better. And because we were turning so many people away at the end, we're actually coming back to the Mint, and our production company is basically building it out bigger. So instead of one show, which was Terror Vault last year, you know, basically you got there and you could go into a bar once you bought your ticket, and you would wait in the bar, which was themed and it was small and cute and intimate. And then you'd be pulled into Terror Vault. We also had a secondary activity called Zombie Tag that was more for kids and families. So we're scrapping Zombie Tag this year because it didn't really, attract the audience that we thought it might. And what we realized is we have way more adults, way more San Franciscans who want an adult experience than we do families who want a Halloween experience. Mm-hmm. So we're focusing on that this year. And so we have Terror Vault Part 2 with all new characters and sets and scenery. Same concept, but just bigger and better. And then we have another attraction called the Morbid Morgue, which is going to be what we were hearing from folks when they would come out of Terror Vault was, it was so much fun. It was so creative. I loved it. I want to do it again. I just wish it were scarier. Not everyone. I mean, there were people who had to leave Terror Vault. You know, there were people who had panic attacks, you know. So it's very, you know, it's that thing where one person's idea of what's scary is totally relative compared to someone else's. But we did realize that people loved the sort of textual, like the not textual. What's the word I want to use?
Immersive. They did like texture.
Yes, a textural experience. So Terror Vault will be more of the the textual, meaning it's a more narrative experience, more of a play. And the Morbid Morgue is more about really pushing your boundaries, playing with your senses, you know. You say you have to sign a release of liability form. There is no red necklace option.
That's part of the scary part. That's the thing that scares you the most is like, do I really want to sign this?
Well, it's that thing where it's like, you don't even have the option. If you go to the Morbid Morgue, it's a much smaller group. You will be separated from your group. You will probably have a bag put over your head at some point. You know, these kinds of things, playing with your sensory experiences. And it'll be a much less fantastic experience than Terror Vault, which was much campier and had big set designs and stuff, whereas Morbid Morgue will be a lot more bleak and disgusting and more like what the actual operations behind the scenes at a mint prison would be like. Very dark, very bleak, you know, laundry rooms you have to make your way through. And, you know, of course there will be monsters and creatures, but it's really, we're really working with a psychologist and some consultants who've studied fear to create this second attraction.
Imagine that you'll have an area where you're a drag queen and people don't come to see your show. And
well, I'm actually probably not going to be in the Morbid Morgue. But I will be in Terror Vault again. I don't know if I'll be in it every night because that about killed me. So we're going to have headliner performers where if you're interested in, you know, specifically seeing certain people, you know, you can go online and find out when they are in the, you know, what nights they're doing the show.
Cool. Have you noticed like this haunted house creep over Valentine's Day here in Chicago? People were doing like some kind of like lovers holiday kind of like haunted house for Valentine's.
Yeah, that's a big thing now in the industry is sort of extending your year. So it's not limited just to Halloween. There are a bunch of haunts that do holiday or Christmas themed haunts, Valentine's Day. I mean, I think really we're it didn't work for us because we actually did look at what that would take and what the budget would be. But the reality for us is because we're at the Mint, we are still technically and will be a pop-up. We cannot be there and take up that real estate year round. So it doesn't make sense for us to do a pop-up for Valentine's Day. Whereas if you have a year round space, like I'm guessing in Chicago, that operation has probably got that space year round where they can go in and, you know, dress their existing sets and stuff.
So are you doing like a St. Patrick's Day themed haunted house and Pride haunted house and something like that?
Oh my God. What would a Pride haunted house look like?
It would look like a Christian fundamentalist house.
We did talk about doing a gay haunted house for Pride season.
Have you been to those Christian morality haunted houses where like, here's a woman who had an abortion. Here's a gay man who lived a life of depravity and now he has AIDS, you know, and stuff like that.
I've only seen the chick flick. Is that what his name was?
Jack Chick comic books. But they actually, like in the South and in some conservative communities, they have haunted houses that are sort of doing, you know, and to me, I think that's kind of funny, you know. But imagine for Pride.
Funny in an ironic way, right?
Yeah. I mean, we're not on the same page. It's kind of like people like are all. Finally, I agree with Ann Coulter that President Trump is a moron. And I'm like, Ann Coulter is saying Trump is a moron because he's not fascist enough. So, you know, everybody who's posting on social media about that. And to me, it's kind of like the idea of, you know, I love it when culture sort of parodies itself without even trying to.
Yeah. Well, we live in a scary, scary time. That's for sure.
Do you gonna have like a room in the haunted house, like 4 more years of Trump, and you know,
taxes are higher now. No, I think in a way that's why these sorts of things are popular right now is because they offer an escape. Yeah. They kind of allow people to exercise, you know, their fears and anxieties. About that shit that's kind of constantly looming and creating this dark cloud, but that it's this sort of like fun and fantastic and kind of silly way of make believe. So I think in a way, if you were to create that kind of experience, it's like, well, why bother? You know, you could just turn on the news.
That's a great insight into that. I really love it.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. So you're working now with a look queen who's not known for being a performer, Kim Chi, to doing a parody of Mean Girls that's coming to Chicago.
It is. Yes, finally. I'm so excited. We're finally bringing one of my actual shows to Chicago and Denver.
We know Kim Chi for years. We know that she's capable of being more than just a beautiful shape changer, yeah, but that she has a lot of comedic talent, and I'm really glad that you're actually giving her that opportunity, and we're going to get to see that.
Yeah, I hadn't realized that based on, you know, the TV show or social media, really, you know, but I went to one of the haters roast shows a couple of years ago, and I think it was maybe after she had been on, like, maybe it was around the time that her season had aired, and I went in, and I remember thinking, like, oh my god, Jinx killed it, like, she really nailed it, and Bob killed it. But it didn't surprise me because, you know, I know them and I know what they're capable of. And then of all these queens, the person that really blew me away and just super surprised me was Kim Chi, because she came up and, you know, you're expecting her to be this sort of sweet and quiet and, you know, kind of, I don't know, like, pretty queen. And she was vicious and rotten, and her comedic timing was, you know, on fire. And, you know, it was just sort of like, wow, okay, she gets comedy. She's mm-hmm. very, very funny. Mm-hmm. And that's when I was like, you know, I said to Bob afterwards, I was like, oh my god, you know, I would never have guessed Kim was, you know, so hilarious. You know, I would love to work with her sometime.
She's kind of known in, like, the Chicago community for being the queen who's in the dressing room putting on her makeup, and she's the one that just delivers the scathing lines that will cut a girl to the bone. But they're, you know, because the thing is that she's super creative and she's super smart, you know? And so she's got those two things, and when they mix together, she's like, she can just hone right in on that stuff. And, you know, for some people it can be, it can be a bit much, but other people, you know, especially if you have a good sense of humor about yourself, it's something that you can really laugh at.
Well, I think it really lends itself to the character, because I always mm-hmm. try to mash up, like, my sense of a person's drag persona with the movie character. You know, for the Lindsay Lohan character that, you know, she's parodying, mm-hmm. you know, she starts off very sweet and innocent and sort of naive and protected, and she goes on this journey with these mean girls, and then she herself becomes a vicious, you know, kind of mean girl. And, you know, so I was, you know, thinking about Kim Chi, and once I kind of realized, you know, I always have this list of movies that mm-hmm. we're gonna get to someday. Once I realized, like, oh, Kim could be the protagonist in the show, it was enough of a twist for me, you know, to have the foreign exchange student mm-hmm. come from, you know, South Korea rather than Africa, you know, and kind of design it that way, mm-hmm. where it's about mean drag queens kind of corrupting this sweet queen.
The plastics.
Yeah, the plastics, you know, these bitches really turning her into a bitch. Mm-hmm. That was enough for me to go, okay, we have a show. Mm-hmm. We have a show there, yeah. You know.
Have you always been a fan of Mean Girls when it first came out, or is it something that you came to over time?
I think probably I came to it over time. I did go to see it in the theater, and I thought it was quite good. Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't walk out of the theater and think, you know, that sucked or anything. Mm-hmm. I actually quite liked it and thought it was very funny. Mm-hmm. of course, I am of the age where, you know, John Hughes movies were what I grew up watching. But when Heathers came out, you know, I was in high school, and Heathers, you know, just blew me away. That kind of dark, sophisticated, really, you know, nasty, cynical comedy. Mm-hmm. I think Heathers was a real game changer, you know, and I think you know, Darren's film Jawbreaker, you know, came, you know, was the film that kind of followed Heather's. And then I think Mean Girls was the film that followed that. And I think you can kind of track generationally which movie someone obsessed over, sure. You know.
And Heather's so. Kind of always, you know, it was a popular movie, but it felt more underground, though. Would you say that?
Right.
Yeah. And the same with Jawbreaker, whereas Mean Girls was like, it's Lindsay Lohan. She's a Disney star. And
right. You know. So yeah, it was super mainstream. Mm-hmm,
in that sense, yeah.
But there's a group of people, you know, young people especially, who, you know, watched Mean Girls in a very, very cult obsessed way. Like, they know every line. They know everything. They, you know, they're obsessed with it. So it has that thing.
Without a doubt. I didn't see it when it came out. And so I would see on the internet all these references to it. I'm like, one day I'll see this movie. And then finally we did get away around to watching it. I don't know, maybe like 8 years ago or something like that. And so since then I've watched it a couple of times. And I'm like, okay, I get why people really love this movie so much.
Well, it's like it's the way you and I quote Showgirls, they quote Mean Girls. So they're like, get in, loser. We're going shopping.
You know? Right, right. Exactly.
On Wednesdays, we wear pink.
Yes.
And
I don't know if it has the same bite as, you know, what is it? Some of the best cocaine were in the world. You know what I'm saying? You don't want to fuck with me now that we're friends, darling.
Well, it's a different genre, right?
But Mean Girls is kind of like, it has that biting wit, but it's a little bit more family friendly. Like, you can't quote Showgirls in front of your grandparents the way you can quote Mean Girls and get away with it.
Well, I think that's the thing. I think young people's parents allowed them to watch Mean Girls because it wasn't Showgirls, you know? And it was subversive, you know, and the kids picked up on that.
Yes. Now, do you know of kids that are that creative in bullying each other that they create like a burn book, a collection of mean things to say about each other and pass it around in high school? Because it's usually like bullies are kind of lazy by nature.
We had the equivalent of that in my high school.
You did?
There was a group of students. It was a big scandal. It even like made the news and everything.
Wow.
Who were putting out like an underground newspaper kind of zine.
and you were the editor.
No, but I was accused of being part of it, like big time, you know.
Oh, wow.
And I actually really truly wasn't. I was one of the suspects for sure. It was called the Blue Nun.
And tell us more about it. Like, what did they talk about? Do you remember?
Yeah, they talked about like what students had had abortions. They talked about,
there
were comics of the priests and nuns like having sex with each other. And oh, I mean, it was really, really scandalous.
Oh my God. I love that. That's amazing.
Yeah. And it was, you know, left all around the school, and it was a big, big scandal at the time.
Wow. You know, my friend Kathy and I used to keep a book that I had, and I bought it when I was in Mexico, and it was said El Cuaderno de Balboa, like Balboa's notebook. So we would take notes and stuff, and we would write mean things about people in it, you know?
Yeah.
And we'd draw maps of the places we went and stuff, and one of our friends saw it, and she's just like, wait a second, that whore, that picture that says whore, it looks like me. I'm like, no, that's not you.
Oh my God.
It was totally her. But you know what's funny? People have described this podcast that you're on right now as a burn book.
Oh, really?
Who are we burning?
I don't know. Somebody said that to me, like, I don't know, like 10 years ago or something like that.
You know, part of it is that, like, just the act of asking and answering questions is very threatening and to some people even insulting. And so when their name comes up and inevitably like I hope if Kim Chi is listening to this, she has a warm feeling in her heart for us as we do for her, and that she is happy that we're talking about her and not feel like they're talking about me behind their back. But I do know from my own experience that some entertainers and artists feel very threatened when their name does pop up in conversation with them not being there to interact with it.
Well, nothing we said wasn't complimentary.
Yeah, but you know, it's part of it is like when you're and I think Kimchi is very strong and confident in her ways. But if you're struggling in any way, just people talking about you and not just giving you 110% complimentary conversation, you know, it can feel like somebody is trying to harm you in some degree.
It taps into their insecurities. But I, to get back to Kimchi, is I have to say, working with her on Cooking with Drag Queens is probably one of our best experiences. Besides, you know, working with you, who's been an old friend now, but also just to be able to for her to take us into that journey, into her culture, into her food, was really special. And you know, it shows. I mean, that video's got like 500,000 views, and people are really into it.
And the difference between Kimchi and some of the other girls from Cooking with Drag Queens is at the time we made it, nobody knew who Kimchi was outside of our community here in Chicago and her fans on Instagram.
Yeah.
And we wanted to talk to her and have her on the show because we saw how much she had to give and how much we could show in her passion for art, for food, for drag, for culture, her comedic sensibilities. And, like, I remember very clearly when we were filming one time and the cameras were down, and Kimchi just looked at me and said, I don't think I'm ready to, you know, be on RuPaul's Drag Race. I don't know if I'm ready for, you know, to pursue my dreams. And I said, Kimchi, everything you need, you have right now. And you're much more powerful and funnier and creative than you give yourself credit for. And if anything I can say to her then that I say to the listeners today is like, go do it now. Don't wait. If you got the money and the time, honey, the only thing that's holding you back is you. And it's like, and she did it, and she got on Drag Race. I remember being in a bathroom. We were doing Cooking with Drag Queens live, and she was like so nervous about it. She was just about to get on Drag Race. And I'm like, baby, you got this. You know, all you need to do is show the world why you want it, and they will fall in love with
you. And the thing is, the girls from Drag Race, they get on there. It's like they tell you they're getting on there without telling you you're getting on there. You know what I mean? It's like they kind of like you see the look in their eye, and you're like, oh, it's happening. And like, yeah.
Right.
Well, sadly, they're very happy. You know what I'm saying? Like, you see that transformation, and you're like, well, there's only two things that happen. Either they won the lottery, or they're on Drag Race. And being on Drag Race is like being on the lottery, you know?
Yes, it is. My God. I mean, I can't imagine the number of people now that, you know, apply every year.
I'm sure it's in the thousands, right?
It's got to be.
Mm-hmm. Did you get
I hope that... the two of you will be my guest and come to see the show when it comes to Chicago.
Thank you.
You know,
I'll see if I have time in my busy schedule.
It was a late edition, so we're really kind of trying quickly to get the word out because both Chicago and Denver were added way later than the other cities.
What day is that going to be in Chicago?
It's March 3rd.
And it's at the Patio Theater, which is like 6008 West Irving Park. So it's a bit of a hike for some of the people.
Yeah, to Uber it.
No. You just get up to Irving Park, hop on the Irving Park bus, and you'll be there in no time at all.
Oh, that is convenient.
Yeah.
Oh,
so,
yeah.
You know.
It's queenvenient, so there's no excuses. Yeah.
And you know what? Because I remember messaging you about that theater, because I know you love theaters, when it got restored probably like 10 years ago or something like that. And you're just like, I'll look into it. And so I've not been there yet because I usually run like second run movies, but I'm dying to see what it looks like because, you know, it's an old movie palace.
Well, I can't wait. I mean, I've never been there either, so it'll be interesting to see, you know, how it all comes together.
You don't want to stop by your old stripper club and just pay them a visit?
Maybe. The Admiral Theater.
The Admiral Theater. So we went to see you and Rena Riffle from Showgirls. Nobody wants to fuck a penny. They want to fuck a hope. And we saw you guys perform a little bit of Showgirls for the first time. And I think the funniest line you've ever done that I've seen is when she goes, you like doggy chow too? And then your response was like, wet or dry.
Oh, yeah.
I think that's so brilliant. And I do it all the time now when somebody quotes Showgirls and they inevitably go, you like Doggy Chow too? And I just respond to them with that. And they just give me these dirty looks.
Oh, that's funny.
What's the best line ever?
That was very, very surreal, that whole gig.
Yeah, because you actually had real dancers, strippers. Just like strippers, like the movie Showgirls, alongside you and Rena Riffle sort of paying tribute to this film.
Yeah, it was the whole show was like a burlesque tribute to B-movies. I think it was called B-movie burlesque. Mm-hmm. And so we were part of kind of a variety show. And yeah, I actually opened the show like doing a Frankenfurter number. And, you know, I just remember like seeing and backstage like more, you know, boobs and vaginas, you know, than I'd seen in a long time. And watching my friends sort of navigate, you know, through, you know, women trying to give them lap dances and stuff was hilarious.
Mm-hmm. Cause there's a lot of gay guys who have not been in that experience before. And I was actually surprised to see the reaction in people that we knew. Mm-hmm. And the, you know, some of them are like, okay, here's $50. Do something.
One of the listeners got a lap dance. A gay guy who listens to the podcast came, got a lap dance. And he said he gave him a boner. I was just like, well, I guess you're bisexual now.
Yeah. Why not?
You paid for it. But the, so, yeah, the weird thing though, too, is like when you came here, I just remember how incredibly cold it was. It was like minus 20 degrees wind chill factor.
And yeah, it was freezing. And it was in December.
The whole week.
Yeah, it was painfully cold. Mm-hmm. And then when I came back last spring, it was snowing.
Oh, you poor dear.
But yeah, I think so it's gonna be what would the weather be like?
And unseasonably warm for you this time around.
No, I don't know. So, oh, well, you don't want it too warm because you're in drag. You know, March 3rd could be anything. It could be 80 degrees or it could be like an ice storm and everything could be covered in ice and you won't be able to get anywhere around.
Exciting.
But, you know, most, you know, hopefully the listeners out here, especially the ones in Chicago or, you know, Milwaukee or whatever, just, you know, I hope because, you know, come down and see the show.
Willem's going to be in it.
Yes. Yeah, so Willem plays Regina or Willem George. She's the leader of the Plastics.
And she's the bully that gets usurped by Lindsay Lohan.
Right. Exactly. And Laganja Estranja plays like a stoner dingbat who's one of the Plastics. And I play Peaches Wieners. My middle name is Swallows. And I'm one of the Plastics. My father invented toaster strudel. And I'm really trying to make Felch happen.
So it's not Fetch, it's Felch.
Yeah, of course. That's so Felch.
Did you bring your felching straw?
Exactly.
Well, for people who are not familiar that with what this term means, can you explain it to the listeners? You know, this is not a, you could say anything on this podcast.
Well, felching is one of the most important and common sex practices among average gay men. Mm-hmm. Once one man deposits his semen into the anus of another man, he slurps it back out either with just his mouth or by using a straw.
I think the straw is your addition because every now and then I get somebody from the mentions to me a felching straw because you mentioned that on the podcast like 8 years ago or something. But those little things just kind of like they resonate with people and they bang around in their heads. They love
recording. Well, the idea you're like, you know, having a sip off of a guy's juicy butt after sex is like a cocktail or something.
So it's that level of maturity as far as the comedy goes. Mm.
I want to know your reactions to, I don't know if you watched the All Stars 4 finale.
I haven't.
Oh, shoot. Can we spoil it for you?
Do you know what the results are?
I did. I saw. Yes.
Okay.
So this is a spoiler alert. So if you don't want to hear this, skip 10 minutes down the road. But RuPaul did a very unusual thing and crowned two winners, mm-hmm. not splitting the award prize money, but actually giving it to two contestants, Monet Exchange and Trinity the Tuck Taylor. Mm-hmm. And people are just like, well, it looks like RuPaul solved racism. Meanwhile, this meme of Shangela going, wait a second, there can be two winners?
Well, then, of course, right. You know what? In Tu Wong Fu, you know, RuPaul decides who's going to be the next Miss Whatever it is. And she it's a tie. She crowns two of them. So
that was the thing I saw first because mm-hmm. I went out to see a show last night and came home. And we usually watch the show on Amazon. So it's often not, you know, uploaded until mm-hmm. late at night. Mm-hmm. But I saw that meme from Tu Wong Fu, and so I kind of figured it out.
Mm.
Well, I mean, what's your take on that? I think it's fine to do it. You know, people are treating this, they're more worried about this than, you know, anything else. And it seems, you know,
I'm definitely over. I really, really enjoy the show. I think it's an amazing show. I think it's done amazing things. But I'm really over the ridiculous amount of importance that people are placing on it. And, you know, if that's who RuPaul has crowned, that's who won. Like, why not accept it? It's so weird to me. And I think this season, especially watching the sort of, And I feel like every season that comes out, the toxic nastiness of the fan culture is such a turnoff for those of us who have been part of a drag world for 30 years, whatever. You know, this I saw this one article that said, you know, toxic fans are ruining Drag Race. And I'm like, yeah, not just Drag Race, but kind of drag, you know, because Drag Race, in a way, is permeated, you know, most drag communities, you know, mm-hmm. Not all, but most. And you know, the effect of Drag Race can't be, you know, denied. And I think it's been a positive thing. The show and the queens that go on the show and the popularity. However, the nastiness and the sort of sanity of these fans who think it's okay to, you know, call Latrice, you know, a fat bitch and, you know, tell Naomi Smalls that they think she should die. And it's like, to me, it's a total turnoff. You know, it just ruins it. That makes me less interested.
Without a doubt. But, you know, we had so many magical moments, especially, you know, on this last season. I mean, to see Naomi Smalls perform that number by Judy Garland in such a way, it was just
it was fabulous.
It was magical. It was fantastic. You'd never seen Judy done like that before,
right?
And to see her just her look, her stunning, and how she went together, I almost was surprised she wasn't crowned just because of her ability to lip sync and to perform like that. And that's why in some ways I love All Stars better than you know, Drag Race, because, you know, we're seeing another a more development in some of these queens, and we're seeing a different side to them. It's more of a showcase for their talent than, let's say, the first runaround is.
It's called All Stars, but it's not played the same way as the other show. Mm-hmm. And, you know, fans need to realize, like, the producers have decided to set it up to be more like kind of a Hunger Games, you know, mm-hmm. so the girls have to use strategy, whatever they choose to. I mean, they're actually given the power to vote one another off. It's a totally different kind of thing, and it's a different kind of TV show. I just don't get sort of the like, if you care so much about who wins, and you care that much about, you know, one of these girls or some of these girls, how can you turn around and, you know, treat another girl, even on social media or whatever, the way these fans do? I don't get it. I think it's so weird.
They're mean girls.
I mean, we receive so much negative toxicity ourselves, and we're not even on the show. You know, and it's like
they
I put my nudes
up.
Some people actually have doxed, like they put our address and said, like, I hope no one sends them, you know, something bad in the mail. And there is a lot of frustration, and I think that frustration stems from people don't feel like they're heard. And when they don't feel like they're heard, they take it out on whoever's in front of them. And so that's why, in some ways, at least I can, you know, here in Chicago, drag culture does involve a lot of drag queens going on social media and attacking anybody that they feel is problematic or harmful or hurtful or because of something they said or they didn't come at them correctly or they're not aligning with their own values.
Mm-hmm.
I know the movie Mean Girls is sort of meant to be a comedy, but it also it's a film that allowed a lot of nonconformists to a little bit of peace in understanding that that bullying is a real issue and that sometimes the best way to fight bullying is just to fearlessly be yourself.
Yeah, I mean, I think the message of a movie like Mean Girls and the fact that it comes from someone like Tina Fey, who probably was not a popular mean girl, you know, growing up, is that, yeah, being yourself, being nice, you know, hanging out with the rumored lesbian and the gay guy and whatever, that's, you know, the better way to be. But that in the end, because, you know, the final scenes always, kind of show that there will always be another group of mean girls coming along. And you've got this choice to make. And I think it validated all the sort of non-mean girls out there. And in very similar ways, to Heather's, you know. I mean, Heather's was just so much more extreme, you know. They killed the mean girls.
But certainly, like, a lot of the drag queens that you're working with right now have been the recipient of a lot of hate.
Absolutely.
And they've not always handled it well.
Who can blame them? It's just so surreal. It just doesn't add up to me that you could be that emotionally invested in drag as a spectator to wish someone ill, you know, or dead or whatever. It's just, I don't get it. But, you know, those people obviously, you know, are hurting. I mean, it's, you know, it's psychology 101, right? So, you know, you go after and you try to hurt people when you're hurting.
How do you handle, and because we've run across, you know, people be like, Jesus Christ sucks, cocks in hell. You know?
Yeah.
How do you handle? I have one drag queen who had really bitter, and I reached out to her and said, "What is going on? You know, like, I want you to have peace." Because to me, I'm like,
"You want the tea?"
No, I want her to be at peace. And I'm like, and then we know Joshua, we know Peaches, we know you're one of the nicest, best people we know.
Thank you.
And the craziness is when I run into somebody who has like anger in their heart towards somebody that I know extremely committed to justice and equality and kindness. You know, how do you handle that at the times you've run across it in your life?
I mean, this is going to sound obnoxious, but I feel like I've been lucky in that I don't deal with it that often. It's certainly not from people in my own community, like in San Francisco. I rarely have been, attacked that way or, you know, of course it happens and it has happened. But usually I'm able to look at the person and see that it's coming from a place of maybe jealousy or resentment. They're usually people I don't know, you know, I don't really know personally, or maybe I know peripherally. And so I try to see it as, you know, something that's not really about me. But that being said, of course, I'm a sensitive, artsy, you know, queen who, you know, if you get me on the wrong day, you know, it could really be a bummer, could really hurt my feelings, you know. But I try to, like, really, you know, think about, you know, well, what causes a person who doesn't really know me to have those feelings, you know?
It's usually
I
It's from inside themselves, right?
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm.
Lee Radziwill died. She was Jackie Kennedy Onassis' younger sister. And I'm reading here Michael Musto's update on Facebook saying that Lee was the one who commissioned the Maysles brothers to do the documentary about the Bouvier family. And she was not happy when they chose to solely focus on the wacky relatives, the Beals.
Right, I bet.
You know.
That wasn't her plan.
Grey Gardens.
So it was Jackie Kennedy's younger sister that got the ball rolling to get Grey Gardens made.
Well, she thought maybe it was going to be a documentary about the Bouvier family. And so they just started focusing just on these people. And then, of course, you know, when it came out that these people were living like in squalor and whatnot, Jackie Onassis came forward and was just like, with some Onassis money, it was just like, oh, we got to fix this house up, right?
To take yeah, I mean, originally the film was supposed to be about the Bouviers and the Maysles even, you know, I think that's how they kind of discovered Edie and Edie was through their research with the movie. And then, of course, they were, you know, more interested in that story.
And why wouldn't they be? You know, I bring this up because you've parodied Grey Gardens how many times now?
Oh, God, I don't know. Lots, loads. Many, 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 many times.
And I'm sure it's a show that still has legs and you'll probably do it well into the future.
Probably, yeah. I mean, the nice thing about it is I can get older and keep doing it.
Well, that's the thing about like Grey Gardens appeal, not just to the gay sensibility, but the artistic sensibility. For Mark and I, we're sort of doing this podcast in a kind of Grey Gardens manner, you know, like
Jesse's our raccoon.
Sharon Needles said our home is like a FEMA trailer.
Wow.
Which that's not true.
I love that so much.
It's a little cluttered.
It's a little cluttered. But anyways,
a lot of things in here are not striking joy.
Inspiring joy.
Sparking joy.
And so, you know, the father view, the delusional dream that gets perpetuated by a co-conspirator is something that a lot of creative partnerships do experience. And I imagine that for you, you've had some amazing collaborators like Heckelina and you know, Martini and you know, certainly I would say Jinx Monsoon is, you know, fills that function in your life. And I imagine that at some point in time, you sometimes step back and say, like, are we doing the right thing? Are we making the right decision? Are we just like a feedback loop of insanity?
Yeah, probably. I mean, I definitely, maybe I don't understand the question exactly.
Do you sometimes have doubts that you're like in this delusional dream of your own making?
Are you living, is your brain a dilapidated mansion filled with decaying stuff, raccoons, possums, and is there a hot young gay guy that comes over and you feed him corn?
Yes.
That's the question.
Well, because for me, you know,
no. I mean, I actually think I would be living that way more if I weren't actually pursuing performance and storytelling and creativity. So I think like doing theater and making things actually helps me kind of clear those cobwebs, if that makes sense.
Because you understand, like, from our vantage point, Mark and I don't really come into contact, physical contact, with the audience. In some ways, it's a virtual experience for us. We see you guys on social media, you know, we'll be having dinner somewhere or at a coffee shop or go to a drag show, and we meet the people that love the work that we do. But for the most part, we're isolated from them. And so sometimes, you know, I'm like, is anybody listening? Am I just going crazy? You know, there is a level of when you do a podcast out of your own home with your husband, that it is sort of like Grey Gardens. And I imagine for you, you know, the healthy aspect of your work is that you are out of the house. You're coming to face to face with the general public. If you do something that, you know, is off center or off base, you instantly know that. You get to hear the reaction.
Yes, absolutely. Because, yeah, with live theater and experiences, you completely know in the moment whether or not something's working or not, or if it's landed.
Mark and I just saw the film Bohemian Rhapsody last night. That's up for a Best Picture Oscar. And
you were late.
I was late to it. I was dragging my feet to watch it just because I was like, Queen's music to me was the soundtrack of coming out. It was it was very popular when Wayne's World was the film. So when I came out of the closet, everybody was listening to that greatest hits album. And so for me, I didn't want to, like, I knew that it was going to affect me emotionally in some regard and not necessarily in a good way. So I waited to see it at home where it was a little bit safer.
Mm-hmm.
Bohemian Rhapsody is a very much a film that follows the Hollywood cliche of, you know, hey, kid, you're a star and I'm going to make you a big star. And now all these problems are going to happen and you're going to die. You know, and part of it is like they make the artistic process seem so easy. And like anytime, like if you look at Tina Turner film, What's Love Got to Do with It? It's very similar to Bohemian Rhapsody, where whenever they're recording music, it's a big party at someone's house. And there's like drugs and hookers and alcohol and people talking and all this stuff. And I was like, you know, and in reality, you know, the creative process is very quiet and involves a lot of work and long hours. And there's not a lot of glamour to it.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know,
I actually thought that those segments in Bohemian Rhapsody were some of my favorites because they were, I mean, the movie obviously is told from the point of view of the remaining band members, which you know, means that they have their point of view, right, and their perspective on history because they were involved in the making of the movie. So I actually kind of liked those parts because I thought, wow, I mean, in their minds, collectively as a group, right? That's a big part of the movie, that as a group, that together they could create these incredible things, but that separately and individually they were lost, and that they didn't have that sort of magical chemistry that could output these hits, you know. And I believed it. I still kind of believe it. I think that it's I mean, everything I do is collaborative. You know, I haven't created a one woman show. I would love to. I admire that. I look at someone like Bianca or, you know, Bob or something who can go out on stage and do a whole show on their own. But I tend to really, really feed off inspiration from other performers and other talented people, and then kind of find my ideas and my own creative spark. So I really liked that part of the movie. I thought it, you know, was, yeah, it made sense to me.
Well, have you ever like been offered $4 million to do a solo show?
No, I'm sure I'd find a way.
Which just, you know what I mean? It's $4 million, but I'm sure at the time it seemed like a lot, but I don't know. It doesn't seem like, you know, cause you know, people are getting like hundreds of millions of dollars now to do things. So you're just kind of like,
right,
it doesn't really seem like it's all that much.
I wasn't aware that Freddie Mercury had a solo album. Is that been released to the public? Sure.
I don't know. That quick Google search.
I don't know.
Because we're like, in the movie, like, they made the music that he released as a solo artist sound really bad. And you could tell that it's definitely from the vantage point of the surviving members of Queen, who are like, probably have some sour grapes about it.
I was reticent to see the movie because I had heard some of the early reviews saying that it made it seem like, you know, that they downplayed Freddie's queerness, and that he was like, the straight people are the ones that really like came in and saved him, you know what I mean? And I can kind of see that complaint in the movie a little bit, but you know, it's I mean, how much, you know, they say he was a real he was very sexual, so how much of that are they going to really show in a movie, you know? And like, the straight people are not going to really have that much privy to that side of that anyway, because they're not going to be the ones that are like in the sex clubs or in the leather bars doing that kind of stuff.
Yeah, it would be an interesting thing if he had lived and been around to tell his own story, how much it would differ from this perspective. And my guess is that it would differ, right? So, you know, but also too, I mean, I agree with sort of the notion that the sort of gayness in the movie was portrayed in a way that was kind of negative. And you know, the one gay person that was closest to him was kind of evil, you know, at mm-hmm. the end. You know, the gay culture seemed dark and lascivious and all mm-hmm. that. But there is part of all that stuff that's like, well, I mean, it was a dark time mm-hmm. for gay people. And probably it was, you know, to some degree, there probably was some truth to the darkness that was, you know, portrayed. Mm-hmm. So it's a hard thing to sort of decide, you know. I don't believe that Freddie Mercury saw his gayness as some sort of devil on his shoulder, you know. Mm-hmm. But, you know, who knows? But I kind of can see those criticisms, but I also kind of agree with other people who sort of have argued, well, no, that's what it would have been like at that mm-hmm. time.
Well, I really enjoyed the movie and the fact that it just kept moving forward. And you're just like, God, this movie is really, it's happening, you know.
Yeah.
Some of these movies, you're just like, oh, I just wish thing would be over. It's like moving slow.
And yeah,
this is like it really got into it.
Mark wants somebody to make a clip of the AIDS cough. So yeah. Movies like Dallas Buyers Club, Philadelphia, Rent,
Bohemian Rhapsody, any movie where like it's you don't know that the person's HIV positive yet, but you get the cough.
The Hours.
You know what I'm talking right. about? I'm sure it's. I'm surprised it's not even done yet.
Behind the Candelabra. It
could be Consumption from Moulin Rouge.
No, but this is like specific. It's AIDS. A singular cough. Boys on the Side and the band played on. All, the Normal Heart. All these films have one thing in common. When they want to show a character having an autoimmune disorder disease, which is not a respiratory function. Mm-hmm. They go, and you're like, instantly, no, he's got AIDS.
Right, know? Right.
And you're like, AIDS is not a pulmonary disease in the first place. So it's not going to manifest itself usually by people coughing.
Plus, people get pneumonia. They do get
well,
pneumonia.
Well, it could. Yeah, it depends on what you. It depends on how you. Yeah, it could.
But it's not an early symptom right. of the disease.
I'm just saying
I think it is, actually.
I think it is.
Yeah, when
it
you
is?
Sero,
of course
yeah, when you seroconvert.
Yeah, yeah.
You have a cough.
Of course, it's a symptom.
You get very sick.
At this point in time, it just seems like it's a weird movie cliche. You know,
yeah,
it's a trope.
I would agree with that.
A trope.
And so you want to see somebody
somebody do a master cut of every AIDS cough.
Because somebody did the same thing with the film Working Girl.
Oh, yeah. It's called Frog in Her Throat.
Yeah.
Melanie Griffith clears her throat. And before she says anything in the movie, she goes... I'll send you the link again. You can watch it. It's the weirdest thing. She just is always clearing her throat in the movie. And it's like somebody we know, his name's Chuck. He did a master cut of all of it.
Oh my God. That's hilarious.
It's amazing. I'll put a link to it in the show notes for people that can watch it.
Peaches, thank you so much for always coming on the show. I want to get you back on pretty quickly to talk about the Academy Awards, because you are somebody who watches a lot of films. Rehearsing with drag queens.
Well, that's coming up soon, though, isn't it? When's the Academy Awards?
The end of the month. So that's going to be February 24th.
So, like, oh, wow.
Yeah, about less than 10 days away. So that's this coming Sunday. And are we going to have time, or should we just ask her right now?
Have time.
Well, so the Oscars are coming this Sunday. Who are you rooting for Best Picture? Black Panther? Green Book? The Favorite? With the lesbian scenes with the British monarchy?
Yeah.
A Star is Born? Bohemian Rhapsody?
Mm-hmm. I honestly don't have... a pick, or I'm not really rooting for.
Sure.
I don't feel strongly about any of them, which is so weird because I don't. I mean, I loved The Favorite. I saw it twice. I thought it was awesome.
We saw it with my mom, and she was like, "This movie has too much lesbian sex in it."
I mean, I probably would push for The Favorite mm-hmm. because it's my kind of movie. I really, really loved it, but I just don't see it. Like, it's probably not what I would guess the Academy's going to award, but you know, I could be wrong. And I have to say, this year, while I saw most of those movies that you mentioned, I didn't necessarily feel that passionate or strongly about many movies this year. Mm-hmm. And so I'm not as excited about the Academy Awards. Some years I'm really excited. I really, you know, get into mm-hmm. it. And I'm really looking forward to awards season. But this year I just haven't really cared as much.
And do we
None
even
of the
have,
movies.
Do we even have
sparked.
A host this year for the Academy Awards? I don't even know what's happening.
Who is it?
I don't. It's going to be a robot.
I think it's like a mix of different people. Is it going to be all the Avengers or something? I think that's what I heard. I don't know. I don't think anybody wants the job after Kevin Hart like turned it down. They're all just like, it's tainted.
Right.
They're saying that Jimmy Kimmel will probably host it. Is okay. The rumor right now. But yeah, it has not been announced yet. That is crazy. That's the Sunday. That is 7 days away. I'm sure they have a host, right?
They must have somebody.
They haven't announced anybody? That is so weird.
That is crazy. Yeah, okay. I don't know. It'll be interesting. I mean, I'm curious to see the gowns and the red carpet. I love all that, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, what's Lady Gaga going to wear? You know, I still get into all that. And I'll probably watch it. You know, we open Mean Gays on Saturday in San Francisco. And then on Sunday, we fly to Seattle. So I'm guessing, I don't know, I have to look. But I'm guessing we'll be arrive in time to watch it. Because mm-hmm. We have Sunday night off. So I'm hoping maybe I can watch it with, you know, the girls Sunday night.
Mm-hmm. Are you when you come into Chicago, are you coming in that Sunday the 3rd? Or are you coming in the day before?
No, we come in, I think, the day before. I'm not sure.
Okay.
I have to look. Yeah, this road show, you know, I'm working with these tour managers now who are Curb Magazine, who've been mm-hmm. producing my shows in Seattle and Portland for the last 4 years. And they have asked me to allow them to bring our shows to other markets, which is a great relief for me, because working with producers who you know and trust mm-hmm. and who you know are good and get the job done is really such a big important part of why I don't go to a lot of cities, is because it's so hard, you know, not mm-hmm. not because people are incompetent, but because these shows are such beasts and they're so yeah. hard to kind of put together. So I'm really excited that Jimmy and Arden from Curb Magazine, mm-hmm. you know, have pulled it together to finally bring us to Chicago. Mm-hmm. Now what it's going to take for us to be able to continue to do it is, you know, it to succeed. So mm-hmm. that's kind of why I'm like, please, Chicago, come out and support us so I can come back with more shows.
Mm. Honey, having you in my backyard would be a dream come true.
Oh, fabulous.
With a felching straw.
Yeah. Well, if your listeners want to check out tickets, it's curbmagazine.com. Mm-hmm. Q-U-R-B magazine.
Mm-hmm. And can people also get those links through peacheschrist.com?
No, actually, they should go to Curb Magazine.
Oh, really? So is there a link on your own website directing
yes.
them to it?
Uh-huh. Curb Magazine is really where they should go, because Jimmy and Arden are managing that and keeping it all up to date. Mm.
So, but it's spelled with a Q.
Q-U-R-B. Yes.
Because it's
exactly.
Queer, honey.
Yes.
Yeah. It's just we look forward like your felching styles.
We look forward to seeing the show here, and hopefully we get a chance to hang out while you're in town.
Yeah, that would be great. Once I get my schedule, I'll let you guys know. But I'm looking forward to it.
Miss
mm-hmm.
Peaches Cross, is always a pleasure, darling. You think you can do my nails for me now that we're friends?
I'm getting a little too old for that hoary look.
I'll say.
Honey, you're older than I am.
That's why I'm saying it.
We're
all too old for that hoary look, but we're going to be whores anyways.
Oh, yeah, exactly. You're ever too old for a hoary look.
You really
know. No, the older you get, the better it is, really.
Yeah.
So true. Whore away.
Yes.
Bye, darling.
Bye, you guys. Take care.
Uh-huh. We'll see you in March.
Peaches Christ lives in San Francisco, California. Go check out, what is it, The Mean Gaze, mm-hmm. starring Kim Chi and Peaches Christ here in Chicago. Get your tickets at curbmagazine.com. That's curb with a Q. Don't kick it to the curb. Mm-hmm. Pull up to the bumper, baby, instead. And get your tickets.
I'm super glad that Peaches is bringing this style of show that she's done here to Chicago, because it's super popular that she's done, like, on the West Coast, you know, in Seattle and Portland and in San Francisco. And I'd love to be able to see more of these shows come to town, because they're such a delight, because we really don't have anything quite like this in Chicago. We do have a vibrant drag community. We do have a vibrant theater community. And this is a nice mixture of the two for all the people that love movies and parodies of movies.
It's like peanut butter and chocolate with a felching straw. You didn't realize it went so well together until you tasted them both, and you were just like, how can I live without it? And Feast of Fun is made possible because of support of fabulous people like you. The computer that we use to record all these podcasts all these years have finally said, I've had it officially. Mm-hmm. And just like fans that were not displeased mm-hmm. with RuPaul's crowning of this year's All-Stars, the computer grew some legs and went out the door.
I gotta go.
It was, yeah, it's gonna cost more money to mm-hmm. repair the computer in the long run than it is to replace it outright. So we are turning to you guys to help us cover the cost of this computer and the audio interface and the cables and some of the processors that we use, external audio processors we use to make this show sound great. So if you can go to GoFundMe.com/Feast of Fun Computer, you can help make Feast of Fun available for generations to come.
In the 17 days since we've done this campaign, 62 people have come forward and said, I believe in Feast of Fun, and have given some money, whether it's $100, whether it's $500, or $5. If you believe in the show and you want the show to continue, this is the way to show your investment in Feast of Fun, in your entertainment and your queerness and your lust for life. Come forward.
We know you guys love Feast of Fun because you tell us. You show it by sharing the shows, by commenting, by interacting with us on social media, by downloading the programs day after day, year after year. We feel that. Mm-hmm. We also need to feel you guys' support. I know some of you guys have been listening to shows for 14 years now and think, you know, someone else is going to do that. You have an amazing ability to make a huge difference. Mm-hmm. You have an amazing power to your $5 goes so much more than $5 to buy a burger someplace else. It means that collectively you guys can bring us out of this struggle that we're in right now and make sure that our computers and our physical needs of making this podcast happen is around for the future.
John Goldsmith writes, I love you guys and all the wonderful culture that you provide. And Kenneth writes, your podcasts are great and I have very much enjoyed listening to them over the years. And Steven says, I love you and your work. Keep podcasting.
Thank you, Stephen.
Thank you, Kenneth, John, Brian, Mary, Aline, Graham, Tony, Raphael, Michael, Alexia, Scott, Alina, and Cole. They were guests on the podcast.
That's right.
They donated money right as we were doing the podcast. It was so fantastic.
And pretty much, like, you know, we have an amazing community you guys are a part of. Mm-hmm. By listening to this podcast, you are part of the Feast of Fun community. You're part of our family. And we don't see you guys as just fans of the show. We see you as friends. We mm-hmm. look forward to interacting you guys when we see you out in public. And we, because we trust that you guys are good people and you're aligned with our own values of not just telling amazing stories, but also bringing in more equality, more kindness, and more compassion into the world. We can't do this show without you. I can't stress it enough. And we are here all these years because you stepped up to the plate and made a difference. I want to thank Peaches Christ, who is always an amazing guest, and my wonderful, wonderful husband, who hosts the show with me every single day, Mark Felian.
Thank you very much.
Jesus!
And I want to thank you for all your engineering skills and your humor and your guidance and your love.
Oh. Happy Valentine's Day.
Happy Valentine's Day.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.